Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Melanie, and I'm reading the Big Bend Sentinel, August 12, 2020. Helicopter crash kills three Texas Park and Wildlife Department employees, by Abby Perot. Brewster County. Three Texas Park and Wildlife Department employees died in a helicopter crash on Saturday during an annual aerial survey of desert bighorn sheep over TPWD's Black Gap Wildlife Management Area. The pilot, a contractor, survived the crash. Among the victims were local wildlife biologist Dewey Stockbridge, fish and wildlife technician Brandon White, and state wildlife veterinarian Dr. Bob Dittmar. As news broke, state officials offered their condolences to the families, with Governor Greg Abbott calling it a tragic accident, and State Senator Pete Flores mourning the tragic death, stating, "They dedicated their lives to wildlife conservation in our great state and lost their lives doing what they believed in." "All I can say is that he was an amazing man," Stockbridge's wife, Shannon, said in a statement to the Big Bend Sentinel, adding that he was a passionate biologist, caring father to our two children, Jameson and London, utterly devoted to his family, and was my husband, love, and soulmate. Sheriff Ronnie Dodson, whose department responded to the scene of the accident, said, "I send my heart out especially to Dewey and Brandon because I knew them personally." With the wife and son in the veterinary field, Dodson also mourned for Dittmar, a Kerrville-based veterinarian, and his family. The sheriff remarked, "Our two local guys we knew. It really hit home to us, and we're saddened by the whole thing." Wildlife conservation in Texas lost three of its finest as they so honorably and dutifully carried out their calling to help survey, monitor, and protect the bighorns of their beloved West Texas mountains, said TPWD Executive Director Carter Smith. "We will miss Dewey, Brandon, and Dr. Bob deeply and dearly." Smith on Sunday said colleagues in Texas were mourning the accident. "These men were consummate professionals, deeply liked and highly regarded by their peers and partners alike, for the immense passion, dedication, and expertise they brought to the important work in wildlife management and veterinary medicine." The crew was in the midst of annual bighorn sheep surveys that take place each August, usually involving helicopter flights over Big Bend National Park, Big Bend Ranch State Park, and the Elephant Mountain and Black Gap Wildlife Management Areas in efforts to control the competing population of ODADs and to count the growing number of bighorn sheep. In the 1960s, the native desert bighorn sheep were extirpated, extinct in the area, and since, local wildlife experts like White, Stockbridge, and Dittmar have helped diligently study, nurture, and restore a population of bighorn sheep in the area, which now numbers more than 1,500 across West Texas. "He was a fabulous veterinarian," Dittmar's wife, Bernadine, told San Antonio's KSAT News this week. "But what drew him to Texas parks and wildlife was the bighorn sheep. He was involved in the relocation of them, and it gives us comfort to know that's what he was doing." Texas Parks and Wildlife did not say whether surveying efforts would continue through August 16th as planned, but Tom Vandenberg, a BBNP employee, said the crew's work in the National Park on August 5th was a very successful day. "They did a wonderful job. They removed a large number of ODAD from the National Park, and the day after, they were going to start doing that in Black Gap," said Vandenberg. It was during the Black Gap surveys that the Bell 206 helicopter crashed in a remote canyon area 47 miles southeast of Marathon, according to the FAA. The federal agencies stated the point of departure and intended destination from that Saturday are still being determined, and the helicopter's tail number is still being confirmed. Carter said, "All of us at that Texas Parks and Wildlife Department send our deepest condolences and sympathies to the Stockbridge, White, and Dittmar families in the wake of this devastating tragedy and continue to pray for the health and recovery of the pilot." The pilot and sole survivor, George Azell, was transported to El Paso for treatment on Sunday and remains in the intensive care unit in stable condition at the University Medical Center in El Paso. Dodson hoped that the pilot's survival would aid investigators in determining whether the crash was a mechanical failure or another cause. The incident is being investigated by the Texas Department of Public Safety, the Federal Aviation Administration, the National Transportation Safety Board, and Texas Game Wardens. At this time, the cause of the crash has not been announced. The Texas Bighorn Society, an organization that partners with TPWD, set up a memorial fund for the families of the three victims, sending their deepest sympathies. We will always be grateful to these men for their sacrifice and dedication to desert bighorn and wildlife conservation, President Sam Cunningham wrote. As TBS is a 501c3 organization, all donations are tax deductible and can be mailed to the TBS office at 1615 West Loop 289, Lubbock, Texas, 79416, online at www.texasbighornsociety.org, or by calling 806-745-7783. The entirety of the fund will be distributed equally to the three surviving families. Coronavirus takes center stage in discussion over temporary Jeff Davis County judge. A lot of us are finding our voices in hopefully a reasonable and non-confrontational way, said one critic of mask requirements who'd come to speak at the meeting, by Stephen Paulson. Fort Davis. The Jeff Davis County Commissioner's Court met in person on Monday with the goal of appointing a county judge to replace Kareth Sproul Hurley, who died earlier this month at 45. Although the court has typically met over Zoom during the coronavirus pandemic, they decided the death of Judge Sproul Hurley was too important to skip an in-person forum. Teresa Todd, the county attorney for Jeff Davis County and a personal friend of Sproul Hurley, said in an interview last week. With residents and officials spaced out at the Kelly Outdoor Pavilion, but with few wearing masks, the meeting started off on a somber note as officials shared remembrances of the former judge. Commissioner Albert Miller described her as a good friend and colleague and a very fine person, while Mary Ann Ludicky, a justice of the peace, said her absence left a huge hole in this court. We are missing a friend, a valued colleague, and someone we hold dear, Ludicky added. Whoever takes this position has huge shoes to fill. County residents were eager to speak when the commissioner's court opened the floor up to public comment. The conversation quickly turned to the mask mandate, one of the last big actions taken by the commissioner's court before Sproul Hurley's death. When Governor Greg Abbott in June imposed mask rules across the state, he allowed counties with less than 20 active cases, including Jeff Davis County, to request an exemption from the rules. Judge Sproul Hurley and her commissioners spent weeks considering the issue and fielding calls and emails from residents. But in July, at a meeting where the vast majority of public comments were pro-mask, they ultimately opted against an exemption, instead deciding to keep the statewide mask rules in place. Monday's meeting was different, though, and in the eyes of many of those in attendance, county officials had made the wrong move. During the public comment period, one resident spoke of personal traumas that she said made it difficult for her to wear a mask, while others accused county officials of overstepping their bounds and warned they could face lawsuits. Another resident accused Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, of profiting from the pandemic and said that the officials at the World Health Organization should be considered war criminals for their coronavirus response. As each speaker finished, much of the audience erupted into applause. In simpler times, the appointment of a new county judge might have been a subdued affair. Rural commissioners' courts are hardly known for controversy, though there are exceptions, like debates over Second Amendment ordinances and musical festivals. And a new permanent judge will be elected by voters in November, meaning any temporary appointment would preside over only a few sessions of the court. But with budget season here, and with the coronavirus crisis continuing in the state and country, these are hardly simple times for officials or residents. And in Texas, county and city-level governments have become one of the main battlegrounds over mask requirements and other coronavirus precautions, a fact that helps explain how Monday's meeting over a temporary judicial appointment instead became a referendum on masks. The COVID-19 thing has become fairly contentious for a lot of people, said Melanie Blackman, a resident who turned out to voice her concerns over mask mandates. There are strong opinions on both sides. While Sproul Hurley's appointment will serve for just a few months, some Jeff Davis County residents fear her replacement could use their brief time in office to push through further coronavirus restrictions. Blackman acknowledged that being a county commissioner was a fairly thankless task, but said the debate over masks absolutely influenced her decision to attend Monday's meeting. A lot of us are finding our voices in hopefully a reasonable and non-confrontational way, she added. I'm hoping everyone will do that. In the wake of Sproul Hurley's passing, county officials at first seemed to have a solution to avoid any controversy. Curtis Evans, a county commissioner, would resign and take on the role of temporary judge. Evans is a widely respected official in the community, having served as a commissioner for decades. But Evans turned out not to be a possibility while currently serving as a commissioner. There was no legal way for him to take the role of temporary county judge. Instead, a more polarizing candidate was being considered, Larry Francell, the county's emergency management coordinator. In other times, Francell's nomination for the temporary judgeship position would have likely prompted little debate. After all, he's another longtime public servant with ties to the community and currently serves as the county's emergency management coordinator, which typically handles nonpartisan issues like fires. But these days, Francell's role involves managing the county's response to coronavirus. And unlike other county officials, like the late Sproul Hurley, who often declined to opine on masks publicly, Francell has been an outspoken proponent of mask requirements. We've got to start protecting each other, Francell previously told the Big Bend Sentinel. He acknowledged that the opponents of masks often invoke concepts of freedom, but insisted we've got to change the narrative, arguing that people's rights are infringed upon by people who do not wear masks, because people who refuse to wear masks present health risks to the whole community. At the Monday meeting, residents accused Francell of bullying mask critics and said they wouldn't feel well served if he took the temporary judgeship position. Larry has made his opinion clear, resident Melanie Blackman told the Big Bend Sentinel, to the point that people would not feel represented. With comments like that in mind, commissioners were into executive session to deliberate their decision, and around an hour later, they came out with an update. Rather than appointing a judge that day, they would solicit applications before choosing one. After speaking to a lawyer with the Texas Association of Counties, county officials determined they could likely at least start the budget process without a county judge, though they'd still need a judge to sign off on any final budget decisions. And they'd stressed that they'd follow the same process in the past when other county positions needed to be filled on a temporary basis. The easiest path forward was to appoint somebody today, Teresa Todd, the county attorney for Jeff Davis County, said in an interview after the meeting, but probably the right path forward was exactly what the court did. The move was intended to allow commissioners time to consider different candidates, but some attendees worried the commissioners were simply putting off their decision to avoid an immediate backlash from the fired-up crowd. I think absolute transparency needs to be there if you expect or would like to have full support of the community, one resident told commissioners. He acknowledged such an application process may be standard, but stressed, it's a different set of circumstances this time. No applications have been filed yet. At press time, though, at least two possible candidates are reportedly being considered for the position. One is George Grubb, a former Jeff Davis County judge who served until 2014. The other is Larry Francell. In an interview on Tuesday, Francell said he wasn't sure whether he would seek the temporary judge position. But, as he saw it, a vocal minority of mask critics at Monday's meeting were trying to undermine common sense safety measures and were angry at him for fulfilling his duties to protect residents. Francell, who serves as emergency management coordinator at the discretion of the county judge, noted that his role has been complicated by Sproul Hurley's death. I'm out of a job right now, he said, but he stressed that he'd served the county for years, including 4 years as the EMC and another 8 as a commissioner, and touted his ability to get grants for the county. He's also written an over 300-page emergency management plan with dozens of appendices, which primarily address wildfires. Why don't you step up and run for office, he said of his critics at Monday's meeting, Take my job and find grant money for new ambulances and technical rescue gear and training for EMTs. It's easy to complain. The coronavirus crisis will likely continue for at least a few more months, and one of Francel's critics may well decide to run. But in the meantime, Francel sees his role in straightforward terms. His job, he said, involves explaining in a rational way that if we're going to get this coronavirus thing under control, this is what we have to do. And for Francel, that means making calls that won't always be popular. The Voice of the Last Frontier Just Got Louder by Big Ben Sentinel, August 12th. Alpine. Alpine Radio, KVLF, the voice of the last frontier, is now available for FM users. Alpine Radio President Martin Binovich announced Wednesday that after 4 years of trying, he finally got a translator device that allows the KVLF signal on 1240 AM to be simulcast on 98.7 FM. The benefit to the listener is that the music on FM will be in stereo, he said, and motorists who normally scan their car radios on the FM band will be able to pick up the new signal. For people driving around and radios at home, they can leave them on FM because it sounds better. Benovich said, Alpine Radio will benefit from the added stations, since many advertisers prefer to air on an FM signal. The new outlet will also provide the station with more listeners, as people visiting the area don't always turn to AM when seeking a signal. The new FM signal will not affect the KLP FM broadcast in any way, but will be an additional FM frequency available in Alpine and surrounding areas, Benovich said. The new FM frequency is not as powerful as KALP, but it easily covers Alpine, just to Fort Davis, almost to Marfa, and just past the Y, the Highway 6790 split east of Alpine. According to their website, at Alpine Radio, KVLF 1240 AM and KALP 92.7 FM, our mantra is live and local. We are focused on providing to our listeners accurate local news, home team sports, area weather, and enjoyable music. KALP, on the air since 1982, will still host country and western and Spanish music formats, but KVLF now has landed a new music format. We've settled in on an adult contemporary format during the daytime, Benovich said. Presidio Education Foundation gifts 120 care packages to teachers. By Big Ben Sentinel. Presidio. Last week, the Presidio Education Foundation surprised teachers in Presidio by delivering 120 teacher care packages to all educators in the school district. Each care package contained over $30 of school supplies, including face masks, pencils, pens, highlighters, dry erase markers, markers, and notepads. In addition, the foundation distributed 15 Amazon gift cards ranging from $25 to $100, as well as two 27-inch computer monitors. President of the board, Brian Vasquez, visited the elementary, middle school, and high school campuses to distribute the packages between teacher training sessions and offer words of appreciation and encouragement. Vasquez stated, "Making a difference in Presidio and beyond through education is our vision statement, and each of you do that on a daily basis, year after year. The least that the foundation can do is provide every teacher with basic supplies, including several face masks," Vasquez enthusiastically stated. The Education Foundation was able to take $3,500 in donations, purchase the most common school supplies in larger quantities to get better pricing, and physically deliver them to Presidio. Furthermore, the supplies were purchased using SmileAmazon.com, which earns the foundation a quarterly donation from Amazon. Last school year, the foundation received over $250 from Amazon as a result from the Smile Amazon program. In turn, the foundation awards this as a scholarship to a graduating senior. For more information, please visit presidioef.org or contact the foundation at info@presidioef.org.
Hello, this is Sonia reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, August 6, 2020. Gallery Takes in New Art Ahead of Opening by Sandra Sadek. As the COVID-19 pandemic continues to grow, so does the COVID-19 2020 installation at 209 West 1st Street, coordinated by Alpine artist Lori Griffin and owned by Fort Stockton local artist Stephen Walker. What started as a singular three-dimensional work by Griffin, a boy-sized mannequin playing with toys, including a doll in a nurse's attire, the gallery has expanded to include four more three-dimensional pieces and two two-dimensional artworks, with more on the way. The installation is looking to exhibit a total of 21 artists by its opening date on September 5th. Every week there'll be some new things and a new dimension and new depth added and grow, like the virus, and what's nice about it is everyone's perspective is different, right? So some of our artists are better known, some of them are not as well known, and their messages are all just as important, Griffin said. And what's really nice is if you stand in one area, you hear perspective or see perspectives and feel perspective from a lot of different people. It will help with the understanding of the virus. The installation will bring artists from across the country, from Fort Stockton and Alpine to Houston and Austin and even Illinois and Colorado. One of the newest pieces is a visualization of stay-at-home mothers who have had to assume several roles during the pandemic. The installation by local resident Megan shows a mannequin with several arms attempting to balance and work on several items at once, including preparing food, teaching, and cleaning. She is always multitasking. She has her hand in many things at once. Really, COVID-19 has impacted not only me, but a lot of other stay-at-home moms who had careers or, you know, had to readjust rapidly, very quickly to their own new kind of home life, Megan said. There's a little bit of comedy, and then there's a little bit of more emotional detail, especially for the mom who can kind of relate, and then also maybe introduce a new idea to somebody that hasn't thought, oh man, this is what's going on for now. A vision for downtown. The installation is part of the vision of local artist Steve Walker and his husband and local businessman J.B. Gallegos to create a downtown art community that they hope will increase tourism and diversify the Fort Stockton economy. Fort Stockton has a long history of oil and gas, boom and bust, Walker said. We need something to run parallel that is more consistent. Walker and Gallegos are drawing on their experiences with the thriving arts community in Clarksville, Tennessee, as well as success stories from other cities in Texas that have leveraged arts into a tourism draw. The couple has purchased several buildings in a square U-shape from First to Jackson Streets around the new Nelson Street Theater as part of their plan. Gallegos is the third-generation owner of the Comanche Tortilla Factory, which is across Nelson Street from the theater and across a driveway Walker's Chunk Arts Studio and Gallery, 107 West 1st Street. We're trying to create a community art district, Walker said. My one gallery started to draw attention to the area. The 200 block back in the day was home to the Hispanic community's nightlife and restaurants due to segregation. When the development died out, the buildings became dilapidated. We're trying to give back to the community. We need to keep pushing in the area to get people from outside Fort Stockton to participate in the arts. A traveling show. The installation will eventually be traveling across the country, with each piece being transferred to different galleries. That's what makes it important to come by and see it here, because it may never, ever be together again, Griffin said. The pieces may also be for sale, depending on the artist. A list of phone numbers has been placed on the window to allow interested individuals to directly call the artist and discuss a transaction themselves. I've had people ask me already if my pieces are for sale, and I just let them know that, yes, they will be for sale, but not until after the run of this entire show is done, Walker said. So, if it goes and travels, it travels until it's done traveling, and at the end of that, then I will be happy to leave it to release it from the show because the show's over. But it never releases and keeps traveling. It's going to keep traveling, but that's not the case for all the artists. Documenting history. Another aspect of the gallery is a banner designed by Cheryl Akins, a local photographer, showcasing a variety of COVID-19 related signs across several businesses, from no mask, no business yellow signs to drive-through only announcements to sorry we're closed signs, both in English and Spanish. Reyes Seeks a Recount After Loss by Sandra Sadek. Republican U.S. District 23 congressional candidate Raul Reyes announced he is seeking a recount after losing the July 14 primary runoff election against Tony Gonzalez by 45 votes, according to the Texas Secretary of State. The final canvas report, certified by the Texas GOP on August 1st, showed Gonzalez in the lead with 12,342 votes versus 12,297 votes for Reyes. Reyes said his campaign has worked too hard for too long and has had to ensure every legal vote was counted properly. This is a large district with 29 separate elections run by 29 distinct counties, many of which use paper ballots where human error often enters into the vote-counting process, Reyes said in an official statement. We want to ensure all ballots were counted properly through an expeditious recount process as allowed under law. Gonzalez was endorsed by President Trump and outgoing Congressman Will Hurd, while Reyes earned the endorsement of Texas Senator Ted Cruz. Our campaign was a grassroots movement that took on the political establishment. We received hundreds upon hundreds of individual small donations to meet the needed $35,000 deposit for a recount. I owe it to our many volunteers and the voters of this district to ensure the final result represents the will of the Republican primary electorate, said Reyes. The Gonzalez campaign claimed in an official statement that they are confident in Gonzalez's victory, which was shown at every stage. We are confident that Tony will win again after Raul's hopeless and selfish recount is completed. Raul's decision to delay the result only helps Gina Jones, which may be his primary motivation. We will remain focused on unifying the party and building a winning campaign for the general election, said Matt Makowiak, Gonzalez's campaign spokesperson. The Reyes campaign had until Monday at 5 p.m. to submit their petition for a recount and pay the $35,000 deposit to the state party. The recount occurs 7 days after the approval of the recount petition. The winner will be facing Democrat nominee Gina Ortiz Jones in the November 3rd general election. District 23 covers 29 counties between El Paso and San Antonio and runs along the U.S.-Mexico border. A Beautiful Family Business, Selling Avon for 50 Years by Sandra Sadek. Everything we've done, we did it as a family. For the last 50 years, local Fort Stockton resident Myrtle Campbell, 94, has been selling Avon products from her house, enlisting the help of her husband and her two sons to sell and deliver products in the area. I had a friend that was selling, and she was wanting to quit, and she asked me if I would like it, and I said, well, I would try because I would like to do something, but wanted to be able to be home when my boys were home from school, she said. Campbell moved to the city of Fort Stockton in 1969 and started working as an Avon representative on July 21, 1970. As a family who always did everything together, it was important for Campbell to get her family involved. Her husband, Lewis Campbell, kept her books, while her two sons, John and Walter, helped her deliver the orders to customers. When the boys were in high school, I'd say, "Oh, go deliver here. I'll drive, but help me stack the Avon, or help me put it in the house or something." And they done it, Campbell said. Campbell's son, John, said he recalls coming home from visiting his grandparents in Ozona and seeing his mom dressed really nice, knowing she had taken up the work as a representative. I mean, not that she didn't dress nice, but it was like church nice to me. And I was thinking, what the heck is she all dressed up for? John said. She may have been contemplating it. I just recall that I saw that when we got back, and I knew. Even during the harder times of life, Campbell could always count on her family to support her work as an Avon representative and making sure she met her customers' demands. When I had cancer, John was in high school, and he worked at the Holiday Inn. I was thinking I was going to quit, and he said, "No, you're not. I'm going to help." And so he took over selling and delivering and everything, and he beat me in sales during the time that he was working at it. Despite having worked as an Avon representative for decades now, Campbell has always been known as the Avon lady among her clients. For years, people would see her in town, and when I was with her as a kid, they would say, "Oh yeah, you're the Avon lady." They didn't know her name, John said. I always thought that was kind of funny to me because her name is on every book she gave out. While the COVID-19 pandemic may have changed the traditional house-to-house selling of Avon products, Campbell has remained committed to meet her sales goals with a little help. Right now, Walter, my son, is helping because all of a sudden they've done away with deliveries and we can't mail our orders and everything has to go digital. And I am not a computer person. So now he's doing it, Campbell said. My whole 50 years, I've never missed an order. Working for Avon allowed Campbell to both earn some money while remaining a stay-at-home mom, something which Campbell's youngest son, Walter, described as fortunate. It did allow her to stay at home, do everything that we did, because the schedule for sale in Avon was flexible, Walter said, and that extra cash that she brought in, we showed animals in all the major stock shows in Texas, Now that I look back at that, that's probably what allowed us to do that, to be able to travel and move our animals and stay in hotels. The fact that she was able to be a stay-at-home mom still, working around our schedules, doing her stuff, and yet contributing to the family, allowed us to do those extra things that we were allowed to do. The Avon business model has changed a lot since Campbell first started in 1970, from only wearing dresses and having to sell within one's territory through door-to-door sales. The one thing she fondly remembers is the many friendships she has made throughout the years. I think the favorite part is meeting the people and the good friends that I have, and I have a couple that are still alive, but I have lost a lot of friends that have passed away, she said. I would like to thank all of my Avon ladies. They have helped me when I broke my foot and couldn't get out, when I have had cancer and had to be gone. Stranger Danger. You received a sex offender notice. What does it mean? By Sandra Sadak. Many residents of Fort Stockton received a notice of a high-risk sex offender moving within city limits. Here's what it means for residents and the best way to stay safe, according to Fort Stockton Police Chief Robert Lujan. The Texas Department of Public Safety is required to inform the public about offenders under Chapter 62 of the Code of Criminal Procedure. DPS maintains a statewide sex offender registration database. DPS usually sends out a notice when a sex offender who either civilly committed as a sexually violent predator or was assigned a high-risk level is due to be released into a community or intends to move to a new address. The notice, both in English and Spanish, is mailed to the immediate community where the sex offender intends to reside. The immediate community is defined as each address, excluding post office boxes, within a one-mile radius in an area that has not been subdivided, or within a three-block area in an area that has been subdivided, of the place where the civilly committed or high-risk sex offender intends to reside. According to Miriam De La Rosa, who oversees sex offender compliance, the risk level of an offender is determined by the crime committed and how likely a person is to commit the same offense again. There is currently only one high-risk sex offender within city limits, De La Rosa said. According to the police chief, there are 32 registered sex offenders in the city of Fort Stockton and 81 in Pecos County. If they are labeled as high-risk offenders, they have to report every 30 days, and a low-risk offender has to report every 90 days. And they have to report here at the PD to our sex offender compliance person, Lujan said. If they're not in compliance, our sex offender compliance person warns them and also notifies the officers, keeps the officers aware of what's going on. If a resident receives a notice from the DPS, Chief Lujan recommends residents stay vigilant and report any suspicious activity or stranger. Know your neighbors, and if you see anybody different in the neighborhood, always go with that little saying, it never fails. Always remember stranger danger, so you get to know your neighbors, Lujan said. If you have questions, call the police department and any police officer will probably be aware of this sex offender and they can answer some questions for you. To find out a list of registered sex offenders in your area, visit the DPS website at records.txdps.state.tx.us or call 512-424-2800 for more information. The City of Fort Stockton's Police Department can be reached at 432-336-4600. Ira Ann Buena Vista ISD announced back-to-school plan for the 2020-21 school year. Two more school districts in Pecos County are gearing up to welcome back students amid the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. Ira Ann Sheffield ISD and Buena Vista ISD have released their back-to-school plan for the 2020-21 school year. Ira Ann Sheffield ISD. The first day of school for the district is August 12. A survey was posted on the district's webpage and Facebook for parents to complete. Here is the breakdown on how classes will take place. The district is planning on returning to campus and implement face-to-face instruction. All students over the age of 11 and staff will be required to wear face coverings. All students, staff, and teachers will be required to self-screen as well to prevent transmission of the virus. Hand sanitizing stations will be placed throughout the building and at each entrance and classroom. Campuses will institute more frequent cleaning practices, including additional cleaning by janitorial staff, as well as provide the opportunity for children to clean their own spaces before and after they are used, in ways that are safe and developmentally appropriate. Whenever possible, windows will be opened to improve airflow by allowing outside air to circulate in the building. Parents and guardians may choose to enroll their child in remote instruction if virtual instruction is selected. Internet access and a learning device, such as a computer, must be provided by the family. Students who choose the remote instruction option will not be able to participate in UIL, non-UIL school events and activities. Remote learning will be taught in an asynchronous learning, which means classes can be taken anywhere, anytime, and are self-paced. Once school begins, the selected instructional option may not be changed until the end of the 9-week grading period. In the case increased safety protocols must be increased or schools are required to close, the district has drafted 3 more response plans. Plan B will adhere to hybrid model, with half of the students attending class on Monday and Wednesday and the other half attending Tuesday and Thursday. On the day students are not on campus, instruction will be virtual using a flipped classroom approach. Plan C will require a staggered start of school, with half of the students beginning on August 12 and the second half engaging in remote learning until August 26. Then they will be allowed on campus. Plan D involves complete remote instruction through asynchronous learning. More information can be found on the Ira Ann Sheffield ISD website at isisd.net. Buena Vista ISD. The district will be offering 2 learning options for students for the 2020-21 academic year. The first day of school is August 19. Families can opt for in-person instruction on campus or full-time virtual instruction with district-provided technology. Once school begins, the selected instructional option may not be changed until the end of the 9-week grading period. Each student, staff, and visitors will be screened for COVID-19 symptoms upon arrival on campus. For in-person instruction, masks will be required for all students and staff. All areas of campus will be monitored to ensure social distancing is maintained. Buena Vista ISD will be issuing a technology device to each student. Distribution will be released at a later date. Students who select virtual instruction will be allowed to participate in extracurricular activities. More information can be found on the Buena Vista ISD website at bvisd.net.
Man arrested in Waikat after pursuit from Pecos. The story was written by Christy Sullivan of the Monahans News and John Fulbright of the Pecos Enterprise. A California man was arrested Monday after leading law enforcement officials on a 30-mile pursuit after stealing a pickup truck in the parking lot of the Flying J truck stop in Pecos. Pecos police investigator Captain Kelly Davis said Michael James Lee Petzl, age 34, of California, was charged with unauthorized use of a motor vehicle and 2 drug-related charges filed by Ward County Sheriff's Department deputies after taking the pickup and driving east on Interstate 20 into Ward County. Quote, a guy went into the store, left his truck running, and a transient jumped into it and ran off, Davis said. The vehicle would later be located at the Alsop's convenience store in Waikat by Texas Department of Public Safety troopers after initially being reported seen in Monahans. Quote, the guy left the truck on foot and was located behind the convenience store, Davis said. Ward County Sheriff's Department also responded to the call, and Sheriff Freyren Valle said Petzl was in the vehicle when it was located. Quote, deputies, along with the Texas Department of Public Safety officers, attempted to locate this stolen pickup, which was headed eastbound on I-20 from Pecos, Valle said. A short time later, DPS trooper Michelle Montoya located the truck in the parking lot of Alsop's convenience store in Waikat, end quote. The sheriff said when Montoya approached the pickup, quote, Petzl fled the scene on foot, heading towards Spur 57. Troopers and Ward County Sheriff's Office deputies began to search for the suspect. Petzl was later apprehended back at the convenience store. Quote, Petzl was arrested and booked into Ward County Jail and is facing charges of possession of a controlled substance, a third-degree felony, unauthorized use of a vehicle, a state jail felony, and prohibited substance in a jail facility, methamphetamine, also a third-degree felony. Bond was set at $12,500 for the possession charge, $7,500 on the stolen vehicle charge, and $10,000 for the prohibited substance charge. Petzl remains in custody at Ward County Jail in lieu of posting the $30,000 bond. Quote, Petzl will be returned to Reeves County and charged after he faces the charges set by Ward County, Valle added. Dollar Tree, Family Dollar, Coming to Monahans. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. A recent post on Facebook by Around the Southwest stated, Coming soon to Monahans, Texas, Dollar Tree and Family Dollar are opening at 405 South Main. Work begins next month with an opening in early 2021. The Monahans News sent an email to the owner of the Facebook account, Around the Southwest, requesting further information. The news also left a voicemail with Media Relations at Dollar Tree Incorporated. As of press time on Wednesday morning, there has been no response to either request. The location is the former location of Family Medical Center, owned by Dr. William Davison. It was also recently announced that Monahans Vision Center was moving to a location in Midland because of the sale of the property. According to City Manager Rex Thee, Burkhart Engineering has submitted plans to the city, which have been reviewed and approved. No building permits had been issued as of Tuesday afternoon. The Burkhart Engineering Company is located in Germantown, Ohio, and is a full-service civil engineering and surveying firm. Ryan Morrissey, an engineer with Burkhart, said the building will house both a Dollar Tree and Family Dollar. The Dollar Tree will be located on the north side of the building and Family Dollar on the south side. Each establishment will have its own entrance. Quote, extensive renovation will be done and about another 10 or 15 feet will be added to the front of the building. The parking lot will also be reworked with repairing cracks and potholes as well as restriping it. The timeline of beginning construction next month with opening in early 2021 is a good timeline. We expect building permits to be issued any day, Morrissey said. The property is owned by Via Real Estate and Dollar Tree Incorporated. The parent company will, quote, likely lease the property from Via, Morrissey said. The disposition of the existing Family Dollar store, located at 1701 South Stockton, is not clear at this time. Here are some obituaries that appeared in the Monahans News on August 6th. W.L. Rusty Hendricks was born on May 5, 1936, to the late Charles and Cleo Hendricks in O'Donnell. On August 1st, W.L. Rusty went to his heavenly home. W.L. Rusty lived in Hereford, where he owned his own business until moving to Monahans in 1980. He worked for the MWPISD as a mechanic for the Transportation Department for more than 20 years. W.L. Rusty was preceded in death by his wife, Mary Nell, and two brothers, C.W. Hendricks and Donald Ray Hendricks, and three stepsons, David Palmer, Mike Palmer, and Roger Palmer. W.L. Rusty is survived by his sister, Norma Lavada Caldwell of Monahans, grandchildren Darla Kaiser and husband Joe, Stephanie Hall and husband Albert, Teresa Palmer, Donna Sullivan, Michael Palmer and husband William, and Sheila Tiefertaler, numerous great-grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren. A memorial service will be held at Southside Baptist Church Gym in Monahans on Friday, August 7th at 4 p.m. In lieu of flowers, they are asking that donations be made to the Parkinson's Foundation or to the Monahans Football Booster. Fernando Sanchez passed away on August 3rd in Odessa. Funeral services are pending arrangements at this time. Arrangements are under the direction of Harkey Funeral Home. Sylvia J. Contreras went peacefully to be with her Lord and Savior Jesus Christ on Monday, August 3rd, in Austin. Sylvia was born August 14, 1957, in Monahans to her parents, Alicio and Cuca Contreras. Sylvia lived in Monahans until she moved to Austin in 1986. Sylvia is survived by her brother, Alicio Contreras Jr. of Monahans, her sisters, Adelinda Gonzalez of Odessa, and Irene Dominguez of Monahans, also 10 nieces and nephews, 16 great-nieces and nephews, and her one and only great-great-niece, Trinity. A viewing will be Friday, August 7th, from noon until 3 p.m., with a rosary from 3 to 4 p.m., both at Harkey Funeral Home. Graveside services will be held Saturday, August 8th, at 10 a.m., at Monahans Memorial Cemetery. Attendees are asked to please respect social distancing and wear a mask. Arrangements are under the direction of Harkey Funeral Home. You may sign the guestbook or send condolences to www.harkeyfunerals.com. John Patrick Pat Cyphers of Baltimore, Maryland, passed away on Thursday, July 23rd, after a long illness. Pat was born on May 24th, 1966, in Silver Spring, Maryland. He was 54 years old. He is survived by his parents, George T. Cyphers and Carol A. Stewart, two siblings, Julie D. Canoza and Cynthia J. Kessler, several nieces and a nephew, and many uncles, aunts, and cousins. He was a nephew of Paul Cyphers of Monahans. He is preceded in death by his brother, Paul Thomas. No services will be held at this time due to the COVID-19 virus. A memorial will be conducted next year.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.